Hello and welcome to Sonnetcast, William Shakespeare's sonnets recited, revealed, and relived. I am Sebastian Michael, and this is Sonnet 34. Why didst thou promise such a beauteous day, and make me travel forth without my cloak, to let base clouds o'ertake me in my way, hiding thy bravery in their rotten smoke? 'Tis not enough that through the cloud thou break, to dry the rain on my storm-beaten face, for no man well of such a salve can speak, that heals the wound and cures not the disgrace. Nor can thy shame give physic to my grief. Though thou repent, yet I have still the loss. The fender's sorrow lends but weak relief to him that bears the strong offence's cross. Ah, but those tears are pearl that thy love sheds, and they are rich and ransom all ill deeds. The devastated and devastatingly powerful Sonnet 34 picks up from where Sonnet 33 wanted to not only leave off, but let go, and like a second wave of pain and mourning asks the young man directly why he has allowed the gorgeous sunshine of this relationship to be cast over with appalling weather. And unlike Sonnet 33, it not only tries, but apparently succeeds at forgiving the young man's conduct, paving the way for an even more conciliatory Sonnet 35, principally and most tellingly prompted by the young man's apparent response to being so called out. What then does it actually mean? Why didst thou promise such a beauteous day, and make me travel forth without my cloak? Why did you promise me such a beautiful day, and make me go outside without my coat or my cloak? Both John Kerrigan in the Penguin edition of the sonnets and Colin Burrough for the Oxford edition point out that there is, or at any rate was, a proverb saying, "Although the sun shines, leave not your cloak at home." Whether or not Shakespeare knew of this and is referencing it here, we cannot know for certain. But what the opening of this sonnet certainly asks the young man is, why did you promise me beautiful weather and make me bask in your sunshine when what happened next happened next? And of course, if there is a proverb that Shakespeare references here, then that makes this question even stronger. Why did you make me not follow the usual common sense advice? Well, what happens next is this: to let base clouds o'ertake me in my way. You allowed me, or even encouraged me, to go outside without my covering against bad weather, only to then let clouds gather and catch me out. These base clouds are surely the same as the basest clouds of the previous sonnet 33, which ride the celestial face, the sun. The bad metaphorical weather that is gathering here with these clouds is not only unpleasant, it is also vulgar, low, unworthy of the young man who is allowing this to happen. Hiding thy bravery in their rotten smoke. And these clouds hide your finery, your splendid appearance, in that toxic or noxious or wholly unwholesome vapours. Shakespeare and his contemporaries didn't make a distinction between smoke, which strictly stems from something that is burning, and steam, which may emanate from all manner of heat-emitting sources, or even mist and fog, or, as here, clouds. The rotten hints at the putrid smell that goes with it, and so the accusation is a powerful one. You are debasing yourself by allowing your beauty, your grace, your honour, in fact, your overall gorgeousness to be enveloped in these stinking clouds. 'Tis not enough that through the cloud thou break to dry the rain on my storm-beaten face. And it is not enough that you now come running or galloping hither after me to dry my face, which has been drenched by the rain you cast on me. This suggests that the young man has apologized, or is apologizing for whatever it is he has done to cause this change of weather. But it is not enough. For no man well of such a salve can speak that heals the wound and cures not the disgrace, because nobody can speak well of the kind of remedy a salve is really a soothing or cooling ointment that only heals the wound but does nothing to cure the disgrace that has been committed. Again, this links directly to Sonnet 33, where the sun, masked from the world by base clouds, steals unseen to west with his disgrace. And again, the moral implications are certainly relevant. I, the poet, have been, or certainly feel that I have been, dishonoured, and you have disgraced yourself by your behaviour. Nor can thy shame give physic to my grief, nor can the fact that you feel ashamed and by implication sorry for what you have done act as a healing agent or medicine, a physic, to the grief you have caused me. Though thou repent, yet I have still the loss. Although you repent your actions, I am still suffering the loss you have caused me. The line does not spell out what that loss is, but it seems evident that the young man has gone and taken something from me, and it will soon become clear in the following sonnets just what exactly that was. The fender's sorrow lends but weak relief to him that bears the strong offence's cross. The sorrow of the offending party, you can only lend weak relief to him who has to suffer and bear the cross of that offence, me. The quarto edition here repeats the word loss, but editors are pretty much in agreement across the board that this must be a misprint, and that the only thing that makes sense in this biblical expression is cross, because it is the cross that one bears. Ah, but those tears are pearl that thy love sheds. Ah, but the tears that your love sheds, by implication, tears of sorrow, regret, remorse, they are like pearls that I see running down your face, and they are rich and ransom all ill deeds. And these pearls are of genuine, authentic, high value, and because of this, they are able to atone for all the wrong you have done. Some editors retain the sheeds of the quarto edition, so that the line rhymes perfectly. Ah, but those tears are pearl that thy love sheeds, and they are rich and ransom all ill deeds. As I have explained very recently, at least once before, I remember very recently because it was in Sonnet 33, I tend to ease off on these old pronunciations because they don't sit so easily with us, and sheds is the same word, it's just spelled differently, and we get this a lot if we pronounce these sonnets in a at least partly contemporary English and not in the dialect of William Shakespeare, which is after all a Stratford-upon-Avon, a Midlands dialect, then we do get these imperfect rhymes, such as here, where we have sheds to rhyme with deeds. It's a matter of choice. If you are a purist for rhyme, then you can and should, in fact, learn the sonnet, read it, present it, recite it, memorize it, internalize it as a full rhyme and say, ah, but those tears are pearl that thy love sheeds, and they are rich and ransom all ill deeds. When, at the end of Sonnet 33, I felt inclined to liken what William Shakespeare was doing to the poetic equivalent of a handbrake turn, then the closing couplet of this sonnet offers a similarly radical change of direction, but there is a categorical difference, which, and this is just one of the reasons why this sonnet is so thrilling, gives us yet another entirely new insight. In Sonnet 33, I, the poet, William Shakespeare, remind myself of the young man's status and simply acknowledge and accept that if the sun in the sky will by necessity sometimes be stained by passing clouds or even by staying clouds for a day or two or a week, then so will every sun in the world, including the sun in my life, the young man. But here, what triggers the about turn is the young man himself. Ah, but those tears are pearl that thy love sheds, and they are rich and ransom all ill deeds. It is almost as if we are there in the moment with Will and his young man, as he admonishes him in this quite forceful manner, putting on one layer on top of another, because not only have you done wrong, it is also not enough that after what you have done, you now come running to apologize, because that does nothing to undo what you have done. Look at me, I am the one who bears the cross of your transgression. And even as I speak, perhaps shout, maybe yell at him, I look at the young man with his beautiful, gentle face, his near angelic expression, and I see tears of remorse running down his cheeks, and I come to my senses and I want to hug him because I can't bear to see him suffer, even though he made me suffer in the way he did first. And I either literally or just with my words wrap him into my arms and say, be done. Don't cry, it's all right. I forgive you. The words I do forgive are not actually spoken here, but they will be soon. The sentiment, though, is already absolutely clear, as is the situation, and this may well be the sonnet that most palpably shows us the emerging dramatist at work. This could be a scene, this could be a speech in a play. There are no stage directions because we don't need them, and of course Shakespeare usually doesn't really write them except where he needs them to tell the actor when to come on or to go off, which includes the most famous example perhaps of them all, the delightful exit pursued by a bear in A Winter's Tale. But here now, in this sonnet, we can picture the confrontation. More than picture it, we can sense it, feel it, live it. I claim in the subtitle to this podcast that here the sonnets of William Shakespeare are being recited, revealed, and relived. And this is one of these moments where you feel you are right there, is it not? It is the sonnets themselves that achieve this. It has next to nothing to do with me, your podcaster. It has everything to do with the immediacy, the honesty, the heartfelt presence of the poetry. We still, with Sonnet 34, don't know what the young man has done. But if for any reason we had felt that Sonnet 33 wasn't quite clear, quite convincing enough, then any such doubts that may or may not have been able to cast any lingering shadows are blown away by this storm, this outpouring of anger, hurt, dejection. Here are 12 lines that say, "How could you do this to me?" And no, you can't just come and say, I'm sorry, it's not good enough. And then these two redeeming, absolving, caressing lines that say, I cannot be angry with you, all is well, or will be. The torrent of this storm and its so sudden abatement leave us wanting more. We want to hear Will actually say the things that are contained, unformulated in this couplet. And William Shakespeare, being the poet he is and being human, obliges not to please us. He may never have intended for us to read or recite, let alone relive these particular sonnets, but to soothe, to reassure, to restore his young man, because as he will say and spell out for him soon, we too must not be enemies, no matter what happens. Sonnet 34 is the linchpin that holds Sonnet 33 and Sonnet 35 in place, which turn around it on this bumpy road to love, to invoke yet another song lyric from a much more recent yesteryear, this time by the elegant Gershwins. But could this sonnet, the one that precedes it and the one that follows, could they all have been written by William Shakespeare as abstract exercises in writing, detached from any experience, removed from any emotion he himself actually felt, unconnected to any real-life person he knew or cared about? We have asked ourselves this question before, and now, just having become so caught up, so involved, so immersed in this sonnet, may not be a bad moment to take a step back and ask again, in all seriousness, is that not what a writer of plays could also quite possibly be doing here, practicing his craft? Setting up hypothetical constellations between characters and putting them into imagined scenarios, is that not a distinct possibility? It is a possibility. Since we remind ourselves of the question, we must remind ourselves of the fact we have no proof that this isn't so. Is it likely, though? Is everything we have heard and seen so far, and everything that we are about to become witness to, everything we know and also everything we don't know about Shakespeare considered, is it truly probable that this is not a man unlocking, as Wordsworth put it, his heart for us? I hardly need to tell you what my view, and more than my view, my sense and immensely strong impression is. To me, as a writer, as a man, as a human who has done some living, a good deal of loving, and probably too much longing as well in my time, this is as likely as it can be a truth that is here being shared. And in the absence of certainty, I have postulated before and am quite prepared to repeat and remind ourselves here, in the absence of certainty, likelihood is our friend. And most fortunately for us, and probably this is not in the traditional sense fortuitous, because it's probably quite deliberate on the poet's part, most fortunately for us, more exhilarating evidence, circumstantial though it may be, lies just around the corner. And so I hope you will join me again here on Sonnetcast as we recite, reveal, and relive the sonnets of William Shakespeare.